I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Mark Laurie and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com, the online retail site specializing in baby products. Mark and Vinny started Diapers.com in 2005, and Amazon bought the parent company, Quitsy, for $540 million in 2010. Quitsy also owns other e-commerce sites, including Soap.com, focused on cleaning supplies, Wag.com, focused on pet products, and Yoyo.com, specializing in toys. Quitsy is based in Jersey City, New Jersey. Welcome.
Thank you.
You both grew up in New Jersey, and you met each other for the first time as friends in elementary school. What appealed to you about each other?
We met in when we were 10 years old in fifth grade, and I think early on we were both big Yankee fans and both into sports, like playing sports, any sport basically, and so I think that was one of the first things that definitely connected us.
I think when Mark first came, by the way, he came in, I was at that school beforehand. And I remember, you know, coming in from Staten Island. So this school was in Tinton Falls by the Jersey Shore. And Mark was always a little bit different, or started out different. He was this brash kid, you know, definitely an athlete. He had a lot of spunk, and I was more shy and introverted. So I don't know, in those early years, we were friends, but I think we became much closer.
Yeah, as the years went on.
Yeah,
right?
In high school. And then after that, you know, we did a lot of stuff together. We studied abroad. We lived together in New York for a year. We were each other's, you know, best men at each other's weddings. So very close.
At what point did you first start talking about building a business together?
I think it was probably in 1999. I was a banker at the time, making, you know, very good money. I was on a great career path. He was a lawyer. Same thing, situation there. And we just asked ourselves, do we want to be doing this for the next 30, 40 years?
Yeah, you did have a diverse professional life before starting your first company together. Mark, as you mentioned, you were an investment banker. And you, Vinny, you were a lawyer. And you helped to draft the distribution plan for the $1.25 billion settlement, which was a class action lawsuit initiated by the victims of the Holocaust against the Swiss banks. Can you talk briefly about that case and that experience?
Yeah, that was great. I had started, as you mentioned, as a litigator at a large firm and then went to a smaller firm, and I was given the opportunity to work on a team of four or five lawyers recommending a plan to the judge to figure out how to distribute this pool of money, which might seem like a lot, $1.25 billion, but actually was quite small in the scheme of things given the number of victims. And so, you know, we were trying to do that in a way which fit the law, but at the same time also trying to figure out a way that we would do this in a manner that was fair and equitable and would have meaning to the victims, because given the fact there were so many, the last thing we wanted to do was give, you know, $5 or something small to each person. Our recommendation was to give the majority of the proceeds to the folks in Eastern Europe who we thought had suffered quite a bit and hadn't gotten, through some of the other cases, most of the proceeds. So it was a great experience.
Were you feeling the same professionally as Mark was when you decided, you know what, let's start a company together? Like, what was your state of mind at the time?
Yeah, it was, you know, as Mark mentioned, it was the late 90s. It was the internet heyday. We actually had another friend that was one of our co-founders, and I was single at the time and thought, you know, this was just a great opportunity to take a risk, be able to work with your best friends, and take a shot at a business we thought, you know, made sense. And so I don't know how much thinking, quite frankly. I think I was 28 years old or something. We were a little bit spontaneous.
We didn't take a salary or anything. It was pretty rash decision.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So this company that you first started was ThePit.com, and it was an online collectibles stock market for, let's say, trading sports cards. And you mentioned before your interest in baseball. You're both avid Yankee fans. The company was sold to Topps, where you both were working. I guess there was an agreement when the company mm-hmm. was bought, you had to work there. At what point did the idea for Diapers.com originate?
I think the idea probably started around 2003. Mm-hmm. I think. So it was a couple of years before we actually launched it. We started talking about it, thinking about it.
One thing was funny is I remember I had just gotten married, as Mark said, in 2003, and I went on my honeymoon, and I think the day I got back, Mark had called me and said, I got something. I got an idea. I want to go buy this domain name 1-800-DIAPERS. Actually, I want to go buy the phone number, I think, 1-800-DIAPERS. I don't remember, it was $5,000 or something.
Yeah, $5,000.
And you would, you know, and you would actually at my, I think, wedding night
on the bus, on the wedding bus,
on the party bus.
I was throwing it out there.
You were throwing it out there to all of my friends, who thought you were crazy. So I was ruminating, you know, during my wedding honeymoon. So when we came back, as I recall, at the end of, you know, in 2003 is when we actually did it. We bought the domain name in October of 2003.
1-800-diapers.com.
That's right.
We couldn't afford diapers.com at the time.
Yeah.
How much was it at the time?
I mean, it was hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million. We didn't actually look even into it. It was so expensive at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vineet Barrara, co-founders of the e-commerce company Diapers.com. The company sells more than 40,000 baby products and was sold to Amazon in 2010. Diapers.com, it's an online retail site for all types of baby supplies, but it is logistically very intensive. It's very exacting supply inventory system and shipping operations and customer service. And you need, you know, real efficiencies in order to be able to make money from essentially commodities. Can you describe what your warehouse looks like?
Sure. We have three different warehouses, each of them fully equipped with robots. The robots actually do and fetch all the product and bring it back to a picking station where somebody who's standing stationary picks from the shelves that were brought to them from these robots. You know, on the right side and left side of this picker, there might be four or five empty brown boxes that were brought there by robots. And so based on what people order and knowing the sizes of the order, we have an algorithm that will go through and sort of fit it into the smallest box possible, like a little Rubik's Cube. And so the person will just see it says make box 3. And then when the box is full, a light flashes and says, now you've picked everything for this box. You hit the button, and the robot will then take the box to a place where it gets taped and dunnage. You know, the plastic stuff goes in there to protect it. And then it'll get automatically on conveyor put into whatever UPS, FedEx, or other truck that's waiting at one of the bays. So as you said, we built all our own proprietary technology, all our own inventory systems, all our own supply chain systems, this boxing software, all the things that we needed to do to squeeze every penny out of the supply chain. Because, as you said, the commodity goods.
How many robots are in each warehouse, roughly?
I don't know the exact number, but there are hundreds of robots.
And what do they look like?
They're basically about maybe a foot high off the ground and maybe 4 feet long by 3 feet wide, and capable of carrying thousands of pounds. There's like highways, digital highways, throughout the entire warehouse that these robots are reading in order to know how to get to where they need to go.
How did you know how to build all this specialized software? Because you certainly didn't come from the logistics business prior.
Well, we were fortunate that in our previous business, the Pit, we had a chief technology officer named Wei Yan, and we enlisted him early on to do all of our development and software programming, gave him some equity. Because in the beginning, we actually worked nights and weekends and hadn't quit our jobs. So he was a mainstay in terms of doing all the technology.
Now, you know, we talk about how efficient and high-tech this whole system is, but it didn't always look this squeaky clean. You started off in a very ad hoc manner. Can you talk about the early days when you just had launched 1-800-diapers.com? What did it look like?
Well, in the very early days, we actually didn't even have boxes. We actually had someone, a stay-at-home mom, that we hired to do the fulfillment and the customer service. So she would use Vonage. I don't know if you know that phone system. That would be our customer service.
This is Gina DePaola?
Yes, Gina.
Okay.
Gina. So she would use Vonage to answer the calls, and she was the only rep. And so there would be times, you know, it took off a little bit in the beginning, and customers would call, and the customer would say, hey, can I speak to your supervisor? And, of course, there was no supervisor. She would say, hang on a second. And then she'd take a second, and she'd come back and disguise her voice and you know, she'd do a high-pitched voice, and she'd be the supervisor. So it was
That's
also
a true story.
Yeah, and she would do this out of her garage. And
she was a college friend of yours, Mark.
College friend of my wife's.
Of your wife's,
So she was doing this out of her garage in Long Island. And the other thing was that basically she was storing these cases of diapers on her lawn. And so there was a whole issue anytime it'd rain or anything like that. What do you do? And the tarp and her dad. It was crazy, right? So those early days, we didn't have the logistics. As I said, we didn't even have box. We'd strap the diapers and the wipes together with rope, basically.
Yeah, right? Things were moving so fast in the early stages that seriously, we didn't even think about things like rain. Mm-hmm. And it was just put it out on the lawn, you know, until we got the call.
Did you just partner with, let's say, you know, these large diaper suppliers and baby products companies? Venturi?
No, this is really funny. No, we Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark, which are the two biggest diaper manufacturers, they weren't able to sell us directly, or they didn't want to sell us directly for the first 2 years of the business. So we had to buy the product from BJ's Wholesale Club. You had to physically go into the store and put it on your credit card and pay for it. And in the beginning, it was fine, but it got to the point where one BJ's wasn't enough to satisfy our demand. We'd have to go to like 4, 5, 6, 7 BJ's and clean them out completely. But it was a long time before we were actually able to buy direct.
Yeah, our parents, we would use the parents' credit cards. So my dad, you know, Indian-American, is a sort of, it's actually just Indian, I should say, huge accent, would be going into these BJ's and would be ordering something like $80,000 worth of product. And but it was done in this odd thing where it was sort of done, yeah, not in the back room, it was almost like he was standing at the counter. And this receipt would come out, it'd be like 10 feet long, you know, $80,000 of it. He'd call me like, "I don't know, son, I got 200 BJ size 3 Pampers," and we'd be like double checking this whole thing, and it was crazy. And your dad too would be going.
Oh yeah, my dad would go in.
We were just using any credit card we could, basically.
So you essentially were cash flow positive. You were getting a lot of cash from customers.
Oh yeah, it was perfect. We had no working capital. It was negative working capital. Yeah, basically were getting paid in 2 days and didn't have to pay for it for 30 days. That's what kept us going. That's how we financed the business in large part, but. Unfortunately, it meant losing like $5, $6 every box we sold. So those losses started to add up too.
So here you are, you're hemorrhaging money, and you know that because these are basically commodities, it's very hard to make a profit selling online. So what was your ultimate belief about the company?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the strategy early on we recognized was all about, first, a mission to make mom's life easier. So that meant, you know, overnight or two-day shipping. You know, 77% of the country now is getting overnight, even some of it same day. So super fast delivery with a really top-notch customer service experience. So 365-day return policy, no questions at all. We have all customer service staff in our corporate office with us. We felt like if we can ship the stuff fast, at good prices, with great customer service and a really wide assortment, that this is something that could make mom's life easier, and they'd sort of come back to the site over and over again, and we'd from then be able to sell them hopefully everything else that they might need.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com. We'll hear more from Mark and Vinny coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com, the online retail site specializing in baby products. Mark and Vinny started Diapers.com in 2005, and Amazon bought the parent company Quitsy for $540 million in 2010. Quitsy also owns other e-commerce sites, including Soap.com, focused on cleaning supplies, Wag.com, focused on pet products, and Yoyo.com, specializing in toys. Quitsy is based in Jersey City, New Jersey. So this was the ultimate vision, but while you were in the weeds, losing money, hardly had boxes, did not have the high-tech systems in place, was there a turning point at some point where you're like, wow, you know what, this is actually starting to work?
Yeah. Well, really early on in the first, 4 months, five months after we launched, it was a small... I remember I was traveling with my wife, and we were visiting her alma mater, Georgetown, and it was a Saturday morning, and you know, we weren't doing that many orders. And we had a back-end system where you could check, you know, how many orders were being fulfilled by Gina. And I remember going to the library, the Georgetown Library, and going logging into the system, and I saw, whoa, there were something like 200 orders that morning, or 250 orders, which for us at the time was a lot. Parenting magazine had found out about us and had, just in a one-sentence blurb, mentioned us. And with that very small mention on some, you know, page 37 of the magazine, a lot of people responded. And so I think we saw there that there was some kind of connection we were establishing with customers, even as we didn't have all the logistics set. I think we knew that we had something. Mm-hmm. It did then take, you know, another 10, 12, actually another 12 months before we quit our jobs in the summer of 2006, before we got our act together and figured out, you know, how we were going to go raise money and write a business plan. But I think within those first few months, we saw that that the customers were telling us that they liked what we were doing. Even though we didn't have it, there was a need. And nobody was doing it, right? Because to your point earlier, you know, it's very difficult to do it in any kind of way that generates any type of return.
What was your family life like at the time? You had just recently gotten married, but any kids in the picture?
I had my first kid in 2000 and the second kid in 2003. So in 2005, I had two little kids, basically.
And I got married in 2003 when the idea was born, but in 2005, my first child was born. So within a few months of launch, my first child was born, so we were able to use the service.
I heard somewhere one of you used cloth diapers and had trouble finding cloth diapers. Is that a myth?
I think that's a myth.
Yeah.
We didn't use cloth diapers.
So you are the role model for, you know, successfully scaling a specialized commodity business, but other companies before you have failed. There's, you know, Pet.com, which is like the poster child of failure and from the internet era. Why do you think, what did you do well that other companies before you did not do well, do you think?
I think first, we had a very long-term strategy. And that long-term strategy was predicated on building relationship with the commodity consumables, recognizing that we weren't going to make money on those consumables, that we would make money on the build off the relationship and selling the high-margin goods. So it was a long-term strategy that required a lot of capital. So it's you know, I think a lot of these businesses probably would have worked. The idea was a little bit before their time, and they probably were undercapitalized. And second is that we did not hire our first employee until March of 2007. So for 2 years after launch, we continued to invest aggressively in building the technology, the infrastructure, and the back-end systems. So it wasn't like most businesses, marketing, revenue-led. We really knew that there wasn't going to be time later to figure that out, that we had to be absolutely the most efficient, you know, from day one.
So you really focused on the back end first, and you knew that, like, the small margin products were kind of the Trojan horse for the business.
Exactly.
You're still not making money from selling diapers,
right,
but you're making money from selling clothes. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I think this is a good point, which is those first 2 years we were building the infrastructure, but we didn't hire our first employees, Mark said, and we didn't go out and raise capital outside of friends and family until also basically fall of 2006. So when we went out to go raise capital, we had 18 months of history. We had a model. We could do reasonable projections. And then I think maybe what was most important for the next several years thereafter was we hit our numbers every month. And
that was
big. With hitting our numbers every month, we built a lot of trust with our investors. We could then ask for more money to invest more in marketing or to make other investments in CapEx or to open up the warehouses.
At the end of the day, if you really want to pick one thing, it was just that. Because without the capital, we wouldn't be here today, especially in a business that had sort of started with negative gross margins. To get capital is very challenging in that environment. So the only way we were able to do that was we kept doing exactly what we said.
Yeah.
Here's the long-term plan. This is step one, and we hit it. This is step two, and we hit it.
Incidentally, this is a side, but I'm sitting here in front of you guys, and just you seem like two characters from like The Office or something.
That doesn't sound very. Which characters now?
I'll take that.
You just seem very like two very unlikely guys to be starting a highly intensive logistical company.
No,
you can take that as a compliment, Mark.
I'll take that.
But are you surprised ultimately that this is the type of company and the type of field that you have really honed in on? I mean, because now you have a number of e-commerce companies, from diapers.com to Yo-Yo and et cetera.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not necessarily surprised. I mean, I think a lot of our business is certainly the logistics and the technology, but at its core, it is about this customer, this mom that Mark was describing earlier that we focused on. There's all these little things, whether it's in our customer service department or in the way we organize our website or how we name our companies or in the advertising campaigns that we try to do that have some humor, and just making sure the experience is simple. So there's a lot of emotion that we try to bring to our brands in addition to the logistics, and I think we hired really well.
You mentioned humor. The tagline for diapers.com is "We deliver everything but the baby."
That's right. That's right.
Who came up with that?
I don't know. Do we?
Did you hire someone?
Oh, no, Mark came up with it. Mark got it.
There's so many things we've come up with. Did you forget who come up with what?
Well, we have another one, too, which is, because we don't have it on the website, but it's on our T-shirts, which is we're number one and number two. So I think that one sometimes I'll wear that T-shirt on the streets and people like that one.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Mark Lorre and Vineet Barrara, co-founders of the e-commerce company Quitsy. Quitsy is the parent company for sites including Diapers.com, a baby products retailer, Wag.com, which focuses on pet products, Soap.com, specializing in cleaning supplies, and Yo-Yo.com, an online toy retailer.
And you said that comment before about us being two characters from The Office. I think we're just real, you know, and I think the company itself is like that. And those are the kind of people that we look to hire.
We spend a lot of time when we interview folks, more so probably than anyone else, figuring out whether or not we're going to get along with them, whether they're going to treat people really well.
And there's one question we ask, and it's the only question that we ask, that if you don't answer it correctly, you don't get the job. And
are you going to give it away? Go ahead.
I got to give it to him.
Give it to him.
Would you rather be perceived in the workforce if you had a choice? Can only pick one of these. Perceived in the workforce as being a super smart asshole or a super nice idiot?
Oh, come on, guys.
Is it easy? It's easy?
Of course.
Wow. So maybe, what's the answer?
B.
Did she answer it right?
Yeah, she got it right.
Come on.
Lots of people don't answer it that way.
Yeah. You'd be surprised.
Just remember, you are then being perceived of as an idiot. Like, it's not like, you know, sort of, you know, dumb.
Super nice idiot. Some people answer incorrectly, but there are a lot of people that struggle, really struggle with it. They just struggle with it, and that kind of tells you something, too. So
back to 2007, you changed your name from 1-800-DIAPERS to finally diapers.com. What is the story behind that? How did you ultimately buy the URL?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. The guy that had it obviously didn't want to sell it for a long time. We made some big offers, really wasn't responding. So at the end of the day, we looked to our advisor and board member, Lynn Lodish, who's a professor at Wharton Business School. And he wrote a letter on Wharton letterhead from him, presenting the offer, and sent it FedEx. And it wasn't until that happened that the guy actually responded to the offer and we were able to negotiate a price.
What? How much was it? Are we talking hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars,
I want to talk about raising capital. You had, a few hundred thousand dollars of seed capital initially. Is that from, your father who was buying diapers? Yeah, on his credit card? Or
we self-funded a lot of it, and then we got some funding from friends and family. But we did self-fund a lot of it as well.
What was the experience like with venture capitalists? Ultimately, you raised about $70 million from firms including NEA, New Enterprise Associates, and Bessemer. Are there any interesting anecdotes there?
It got easier each round. The first round was very, very challenging. Like, this was at the end of 2006. We weren't able to get any of the really big VCs, so Bessemer, Excel, and NEA came in the B, C, and D rounds. The A round was really challenging, so we wind up looking to a lot of the angel investors that supported us at thepit.com. We sort of pieced that $4 million together.
One of the things I do remember was it was definitely easier later, except for 2008. After the meltdown.
Oh, yeah, after the meltdown in 08,
So we had a term sheet. We're ready to go. We were doing the diligence. And every day, the market was down 100 points, down 200 points. And at some point, we just didn't know whether the deal was going to close. And to Excel's credit, actually, and Samir Gandhi, who was on our board, he honored the commitment because who knew what was going to happen at that point just in terms of the economy. But until you actually the money's in the bank, you don't know whether that deal is going to close. And so he was West Coast time, and they were just sort of dilly-dallying at the end with sort of some signatures and stuff. And I think the wiring deadline was 3 o'clock, right? 3 o'clock Pacific time. And, and it was 2:55, and we thought, money's going to come in, money's going to come in, money's coming in, and we were calling him. And at some point, it's like, you know, why don't we just wire the money tomorrow? I remember saying
that.
We're like, no, you gotta wire it today. No, you got to wire it today. It's nerve-wracking, you know, because you'd hear stories about people, you know, pulling the plug, even when you thought the deal was done.
I want to switch gears. I want to talk about Amazon. You have been obsessed with Jeff Bezos and Amazon. They've been, you know, both a role model and a fierce competitor up until they bought you in 2010. And one example of your kind of hyper-focus on them is one of you has read every 10K since 1996.
Well, I think they were, a decade ahead of us in terms of when they started that business. So there were a lot of learnings for us. Reading those 10Ks was incredibly valuable. As we read 10Ks of other retailers in the space, Toys R Us and Walmart and stuff, really just trying to understand the retail space. Neither one of us had any retail experience at all.
I remember one letter to shareholders. He writes these great letters to shareholders every year, and I think personally pens them. And one of them that we refer to often is, you know, they're a very analytical company, as we are, very data-driven, do a lot of things based on the math of what makes sense. But there are certain decisions, and in his example that he gives in his letter, he's talking about prices. And in every price test that they did, a short-term price test, you know, it never paid to cut prices. But that at times, you just have to use judgment. And those are the hard decisions, the ones where you can't solve with math. And I think we also, you know, sort of that was something that I at least, and Mark and I have sort of taken to heart too, which is we're an incredibly analytical company, but there's all of these decisions along the way that are very judgment-oriented, that you're not going to be able to use math. You just kind of have to use your instincts.
What's one really good example?
I think the colored boxes that we send out, for example, soap.com. If you ever to order from Soap, it's basically the outer corrugate box that goes to UPS is blue, green, red, and I think orange on each of the four sides, full color box. It costs probably an extra 30 cents to put that in color versus just a brown corrugate. But we believe in the power of marketing and those boxes sitting in the lobbies of New York City apartments and things.
I mean, the way we approach customer service itself, which is, you know, we invest a lot in it. It's expensive.
Handwritten notes, too. We send out about 200 handwritten notes per day out to customers. You know, any customer that has, you know, a bad experience or a complaint or things, and the customer service representatives will take the time to do that.
You know, ultimately, you were very focused on Amazon throughout the whole period leading up to their purchase. And at one point, they started paying attention to you. How did you know that they started paying attention to you?
To look at their prices.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, yeah.
I think, you know, you could just tell by looking at the prices. And then they launched Amazon Mom, I think in 2010, 2009, I forget the years now, 2009.
It's 30% off diapers.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we could tell at that point that there was a big player in the space. There was always a big player in the space, but it was going to be, you know, a little bit more challenging with those kinds of prices.
And when that started happening, were you like, let's put on the boxing gloves? Or what was your emotional reaction to that?
Well, I think that the good thing, and even today, is that our customers, you know, we're not necessarily competing over the same customers. You know, we're different businesses. You know, I think there was certainly obviously some concern, but we were pretty resilient, you know, and I think what happened after that was I think, a testament to what we had built and also the differentiation that we had created from Amazon and a lot of the other folks in the marketplace is that we were okay.
How did Amazon first approach you to buy you?
That's something we probably can't discuss, right? The specifics of that?
Right.
Just the whole process, I mean, because...
What is so secretive about that? Like,
if we told you, then you'd know.
I mean, I think at the end of it, it's a small world, actually, and there were introductions made, you know, from people who knew each other on our board and who were on their management team, and that was sort of the early discussions. And then I think lots of different things happened, I think, just to put it that way, in 2010.
Lots of different things. What do you mean?
Probably can't get into all the details of how that, the whole process, but...
Okay.
I think it's safe to say it was very unique circumstances that if we told you, you'd get it. So I think it's just one of those things that we don't know how to do it because it's very unique, it's confidential, and it's difficult to share.
Okay, I respect that.
It would be fun. It'd be fun to tell you this. It's a great story. It's a great story.
So we have some time left. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you think would be interesting to talk about? Any interesting anecdotes, such as how Amazon came to acquire you? What impact, if any, do your wives or the women in your life have on the business?
Well, Mark's sister, her name is Brooke, And Brooke is very, very famous with all the Quitsy employees because Brooke will tell us and Mark, and then Mark will tell everybody else, anytime, any product, anywhere on any of the websites is out of stock.
And any description that's wrong, and any picture that's wrong.
I mean,
and
Mark's sister, when Mark starts off with, I was talking to my sister, you know something bad is next. So my wife, probably unpopular, actually, with the rest of our employees, because usually it's a constructive criticism about what we could be doing better, or I couldn't find this, or just some sort of gentle improvement that we can be making.
What's an example?
For example, it was my kid's birthday the other day, and he wanted a certain type of car. And our objective and our mission at Yo-Yo, which is our toy store, is to carry everything. And so I will say, but we're not there yet. And so I'll say, hey guys, I just have to let you know that I'm one of the founders of this company, but I had to go to Amazon to buy, my son's birthday gift. When I'll refer to this, I'll say, my wife, she's checking Amazon, or some other site, as opposed to Yo-Yo.
Vinny, I'm just curious, your parents, are they immigrants?
Yes.
Where are your parents from?
So my parents are from India, from the northern part of India. They came
from Punjab?
They're actually, from the Punjab area. They were in what was previously Pakistan. So in 1947, my dad and my mom actually emigrated to the Indian side during the riots, and then came over, went to London and then to the U.S. But with we talk a lot about risk and where our backgrounds and why we started this company. And interestingly enough, my parents sometimes, think that we shouldn't take all these risks or shouldn't start these companies. But the risks that they took were way more challenging and way more substantial than what we did by quitting our jobs. My parents' story, as so many immigrant stories, is probably part of how I approach life and risk and why we decided to do what we do.
What role do your parents play in the company now, if any?
Well, my dad will definitely Google every, he's Googling my brother, too. He Googles our company and likes to read all this stuff. But, unlike our wives, he doesn't really give any advice about how to run it, but he likes to read about it all the time. I know that.
Your brother, did he start a company?
No. He's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. And so, he's in the press quite often as well. And so my dad always loves to read about him, too.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Great. Excellent.
My guests have been Mark Lorre and Vinny Barrara, co-founders of Diapers.com. Coming up, we'll meet Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment, including iPhones, BlackBerries, iPads, and recent Apple computers, among other items. The company was launched in 2006 and has recycled more than 1 million devices since inception. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
Could you please describe how Gazelle works? Let's say I have a BlackBerry Curve that I want to get off my hands.
What you do is go to our website, either on the desktop or on your mobile device, and look up the specific model that you want to sell. You'll answer a couple of simple questions about the condition of the item, and you get a price. And if you like the price, you'll give us your shipping address so we can send you packaging, and we'll pay for the shipping. As soon as you put the item in the mailbox and ship it to us, we'll receive it, inspect it, make sure that it's as described by you, and then send you the payment.
Now, you're a consumer-facing business, but it hasn't always worked this way. You initially tried partnering with businesses when you first launched. Can you describe that experience and some examples of that?
We've gone through quite an evolution. So in the early days, what we wanted to do is access consumers that buy product, and what a better place than go to Best Buy, go to Radio Shack, go to Amazon, eBay, where consumers buy new product, and help those companies, those retailers, offer a trading service to their customer base. It just made a lot of sense. What the struggle was back then was that the economy was flourishing, the whole sustainability movement was just getting started, and frankly, this was not top on anybody's list.
And was there a catalyst or a specific event that really gave you the engine and the motivation to say, okay, we're going to change direction?
Yes, it's quite memorable. So we spent a lot of time with Best Buy. In April of 2007, we got a call in the evening basically saying that while they appreciate all the work that we've put into developing the program with them, they were going to pass. We were running out of cash. And again, we either had to close shop or change direction in a very aggressive way.
You also changed course at an auspicious moment. The economy was collapsing, which ironically was beneficial for the company. How come?
It was very beneficial to Gazelle because the biggest opportunity was to build awareness that all the stuff that's in your drawers, in your closets, the you know, the 5-year-old BlackBerry, the 3-year-old laptop that you're not using anymore, has a value. It's collecting dust. So in the early days, it was really all about cash for your gadgets that you're not using, as opposed to where it is today, much more upgrading.
The number of devices that you accept is roughly less than 500. But back then, it was over, what, 200,000?
It was hundreds of thousands, including movies and games and GPS systems. Was everything under the sun except for TVs.
And what percent of these devices do you actually, are you able to resell versus that you're stuck with?
Everything has value. The only question is how much. From day one, everything that we acquired and paid value for, we are able to turn around and sell at a profit. So currently we resell 100% of the product, or if it's not 100%, it's 98%, 99%. The interesting thing about this business, which has always fascinated me, is that it's a supply-constrained business. Demand is insatiable.
You have spoken about the car trade-in business as an analogy to what you're doing. What parallels or similarities do you see, and what would you like to replicate?
Sure. So in the car business, 40 to 50% of all new car sales have a trade-in involved in it. So it's so consumer behavior around trade-in, to your point, is inherent in the way we buy new cars. That figure for consumer electronics is about 3%. Inertia is a very strong kind of human behavior, consumer behavior. When you buy the new, let's say, iPhone, you don't care a whole lot about the old device. It's sort of your ex at the time. So building awareness for the value of the devices and then convincing consumers that there is a service out there in Gazelle that provides a much easier, much more convenient, much faster, much safer way to get that value for your device is a challenge, a marketing challenge for us.
So when you buy these devices, whom are you selling the used devices to?
I would say it falls into three different categories. The biggest market is in the emerging countries, Southeast Asia. It goes into the Philippines, into Malaysia. The Middle East is a big market, Nigeria. A second category of buyers are insurance companies. When you lose your phone, you drop it in the water, well, you're not getting a new one. The third would be consumers that don't get the warranty or consumers that want to buy a used laptop, a used iPad for their kids maybe.
They'll go to
eBay, they'll go to Amazon, they'll go to our store on those marketplaces and buy directly from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Personal circumstances caused you to move back to Boston in 2006. You at the time had been living in the San Francisco area, but your wife wanted to move back to her hometown in Boston. Can you describe that moment?
It was obviously a very important moment in our relationship. And we had an 18-month-old, we had an 8-week-old, two girls. And, you know, both I and my wife, both of us grew up with lots of family around us. And my family was in Israel at the time. And we tried once to fly to Israel from the Bay Area. And it was a complete disaster with the baby crying for 10 straight hours on the flight. And it was time to pack up, move to Boston and be close to family. Hmm. And figure out the career stuff later.
Right. You mentioned your family was in Israel. You actually were born in Peru and spent the first 5 or 6 months of your life in Peru. What brought your parents to Peru initially?
So my dad spent 25 years with the Israeli army. He specialized in training of tanks. I guess at the time, in 1970, the Israeli army was in the process of selling tanks to the Peruvian army. I was born there. And they spent about a year there before moving back to Israel.
Were your parents in Israel when the country was founded after World War II?
Both of them were. My dad was born in Bulgaria, so he moved to Israel 3 years before the country was founded. My mom actually was born in Jerusalem under the British mandate.
You spent the first 18 years of your life roughly in Israel. What was the reason for moving to the United States?
Yes, so my my parents in the late 80s, it was actually pretty tough times in Israel in terms of a very prolonged recession. Nobody in my family has ever been to college at the time, and they just felt that education and just giving us an opportunity was their life mission. And I guess they said it's now or never, and just got on the plane and moved here with absolutely no prospects for a job.
So you get off the plane, and what next?
What next? So first, you're intimidated by moving to New York. It was really scary, actually, in the early days. My father scrambling to find a job, my mom looking for a job, I was looking for a job, and it was really all about survival.
What were some of the early jobs you got?
It was for a video store. It was 77th Street and Lexington Avenue. Okay. Video Vogue, no longer there. And they were selling consumer electronics in the front. I grew up just loving watching movies. So the idea of working at a store, even was it $4 an hour, bringing movies home and watching them for free, was very appealing to me. I started working there and really didn't have a plan for where to take it.
What else about, just in addition to building a work ethic and having to scramble, how else did working in the video store influence
right.
you? I mean, there were electronics in the front of the store. Was there any resonance there?
Well, basically, the purpose of the store was to serve the clientele of the Upper East Side and provide the highest possible customer service known to mankind.
Okay.
So some of the customers were Woody Allen, Robin Williams, Ron Perlman, and they were just very demanding customers. So it was all about doing whatever it takes. But frankly, for me, it was a shock to the system. My first images were not kind of happy memories of watching movies. Was my first winter in New York, delivering movies on my feet while it was snowing and blizzards on the streets, going 10, 20 blocks on Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, delivering movies to those glamorous apartments, mansions in Manhattan. Just my jaw was dropping every time I was dropping off a movie in some of those places. That was cleaning the toilet, frankly, and cleaning the shelves and making sure the store looked good and that it was welcoming to our customers. Those were their early days at Video Vogue.
So moving from Video Vogue to NYU, where you finally went to college and got a degree, what were your ambitions professionally? Were you just trying to make ends meet, or did you have some longer-term plan?
So living in New York, it was kind of natural to gravitate to the finance world. I don't remember the name of the book, but I remember a book that was written about the life of Ron Perlman. It was coincidentally a weekend day that he stopped by.
Ron Perlman being the
Revlon guy, the corporate raider of the 1980s. Which started to get me thinking about Wall Street. The movie Wall Street obviously came out in 1987. And I feel that's something that I could actually pursue.
What were your parents doing, incidentally? What kind of jobs did they hold?
So my dad was a limo driver, a car service driver. And my mom worked at one of the Israeli newspapers.
After you graduated from NYU, your first job outside of college was at Harvard Business School writing cases for them. And one of the cases you happened to help write was about Microsoft, where you went out to Seattle and you wrote about Bill Gates. Can you describe any interesting tidbits from that experience?
Yeah, that experience clearly planted a seed in me about the future of technology. And one of the things that Bill Gates said at the office, we spent about 3 hours with him. One thing that he said that I'll never forget was that Israel, one of the best ways to change the world is through technology, which has become evident over the years, obviously, with the companies like Microsoft and others. But for me personally, coming from my business background, my finance background, I frankly didn't know who Bill Gates was. I was barely using email at the time, let alone Windows. So that was a whole new world to me. Now, at the time, I didn't know what to do with it. Other than the fact that it was intriguing and interesting, I still had that Wall Street bug in me, so I had to go back and get it out of my system.
So you ultimately went to Goldman Sachs and graduated from HBS and got the Wall Street bug out of you. And then you begin a whole new chapter professionally, which is really in startups and e-commerce. Even though you were an employee at these companies, you still had this entrepreneurial itch because in 1997, actually while you were still at Goldman Sachs, you co-authored a business plan for a startup called Cosmo.com, which at the time was an internet-based video rental business,
right,
which at one point had a $1 billion valuation in 99.
Yes, they actually filed the S-1 in March of 2000, and they were ready to go public.
How did you come to be on the founding team of Cosmo?
So one of my cubemates at Goldman was the co-founder of Cosmo, and he came up with the notion of the idea behind Cosmo right after the Amazon IPO. He approached me because he knew about my experience working at Video Vogue. And we worked together for about 6 months, nights and weekends, developing the business plan, coming up with a name. And at the end of the day, he decided to leave Goldman and pursue it full time and build Cosmo. I decided to go back to business school.
Were there any impressions from that experience that you've carried with you?
That the world was going to change. It was pretty clear that the world was about to change and the internet was going to revolutionize everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. What were some important impressions from eBay or your PayPal experience that have carried over to Gazelle?
What was amazing about that time is to spend 2 years with entrepreneurs in those markets, building their companies from scratch, learning about their challenges of building a business, how they think about an exit strategy, whether eBay was going to buy them, an IPO, a different kind of partnership. So I just soaked up all that knowledge. That was really helpful for me to get a glimpse of what it's like to be an entrepreneur in all those different markets.
I want to go back to the early days of Gazelle for a moment. I want to talk about venture capital. In 2008, even though you had this auspicious moment where the economy was collapsing and people wanted to, you know, resell their items, the economy was collapsing. So their, you know, venture capitalists did not have their checkbooks open. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, first thing I'll say, it was never easy to raise capital in my experience at Gazelle. But the context of when you raise money obviously is critical. And you're raising a good point. So in late 2008, we were raising our second round of capital. So the first round was completed in 2007. Venrock, who incidentally was one of the early investors in Apple, was the lead investor of the Series A. Now, in November of 2008, we were ready to close the B round with Rockport Capital. And I'll never forget the day when we were going to close the deal. That was one of the days that the Dow was fell 1,000 points. And I was really nervous about, is this deal going to close? And I remember at the time, even the Rockport guys, I mean, they still wanted to pursue it, but everybody was getting cold feet. There was the week after the, I don't know if you remember, the Sequoia presentation came out about how the world was going to come to an end and investments were going to shut down and companies had to scale back their growth ambitions. And here we are pitching a story about growth and about how this is the, you know, the recession and this dynamics in the market was one of the best things that ever happened to Gazelle. So it helped us push the deal through and get it done. But was it easy? Absolutely not.
You co-founded Gazelle with Rousseau Aurelien and James Michelini. Even before you came on board, Rousseau and James were seriously flirting with this concept, and they had borrowed $60,000 to buy used equipment that they then repurposed and sold on eBay for $500,000. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, so that was fascinating for me when I met with Rousseau, and he was telling me that story in terms of the success they were having, and his point was, everything sells. Everything sells at good profit. The only challenge that we have is getting more equipment. And that was kind of the foundation for the idea for Gazelle and Recommerce. At the time, the whole consumer electronics business on eBay was a $14 billion business. It was just a lot of demand.
So it was Rousseau who had the initial idea for this re-commerce, recycling business.
Yeah, what I love the most about Rousseau is such an amazing guy. He's the true visionary guy. Amor, the guy with 2 feet on the ground, getting stuff done. He was really the visionary guy. What really sold me on joining him and, James was his grand vision. And his grand vision was to introduce the concept of trade-ins into other consumer categories, starting with electronics, but also sporting goods, golf clubs, fashion items, IT equipment, servers, etc. So the vision was big. Now, pretty quickly after joining the team and we started actually thinking about developing a plan, we had to start somewhere in a narrow focus.
Now, Rousseau is from Haiti.
Yes. And we kind of went together through the earthquake in Haiti, where his parents' house was completely demolished by the earthquake, and they moved to the U.S. and kind of seeing him going through that period, you know, tough period in his life, his family's life, was interesting and, you know, something I could definitely empathize with.
Simultaneously, while Rousseau and James were pursuing this concept on the East Coast, while you were still back west, you wanted to recycle your own mobile equipment. What was that story?
The story was before I moved back here, before I knew about Rousseau, I went down to a retail store and tried to recycle a couple of BlackBerry phones. And I go in and I ask the guy how much for these phones, and the guy goes, $20. Said, $20, I can sell them on eBay for $75. And he goes, no, actually, we're going to charge you $20 for the privilege of recycling. And that was when I had this big aha moment. The consumers are not going to pay for the privilege of recycling. And that's how, the idea of re-commerce kind of started germinate in my head.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
My guest has been Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.